Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. A little later on the program, we're going to be hearing from David Robleski. He is the author of the best-selling novel, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle. And we are also going to have Robert Knott on. In fact, Robert Knott is here right now. He and Matt Sanford are co-authors and co-directors of the new play, Dead Man's Jest, which is running at Warehouse 21 this weekend. And Ryan Kochevar is one of the actors in that play. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Buenos dias.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
So this is a play. How surprising. Sword fights, antics, a little Shakespeare, mistaken identity. It's got the stamp of Robert Knott all over it.
Well, Robert Knott and Matt Sanford, it has a sweeter edge to it than some of my stuff, and that's been one of the nice things about working with Matt. It's got a really nice love story, a two-way love story, and we definitely borrowed from Comedy of Errors, which we saw a great production, which we have to credit Mario Cabrera with. He directed it, and a terrific MGM movie called Scaramouche. We did start out with a different project, which didn't quite work out due to copyright issues.
Which is unfortunate. That was a good 20 pages we had.
Can you say more about that?
Well, initially we started with the idea of Dr. Watson from the Sherlock Holmes mysteries.
Yes.
We sort of wanted to take this sidekick, which has always been sort of portrayed as the quintessential bumbling sidekick, and sort of make him the hero. And we were going to pit him against Dracula.
but there are copyright issues.
That didn't
issues.
Work out so well. Yeah, some very stringent copyright issues, both from the Arthur Conan Doyle estate and the Bram Stoker estate. So that pretty much negated both of our lead characters.
It did.
So now a couple of your lead characters are played by you, twins separated at birth.
This is true. Yes, I played two different brothers,
right?
Written in the show, yeah.
Now, how do you do that? Do you ever have a stunt double or anything like that? I mean, you play both roles.
We didn't really have the luxury to have any doubles, so it's a lot of running and a lot of very, very fast costume changes.
And there's some really delightful shtick. He, as one character, he runs away from some Corsicans who are pursuing him as the cowardly brother. And then he zooms around the other side of the set pursuing them as the pirate. And we've kept the costume changes to a minimum, but he's doing a great job. And he and Ryan worked out all the sword fights, which include some extra super scary routines. And Matt has a pretty funny story about that.
Oh, why don't you tell him exactly what it is that you do?
Oh,
at the
boy.
Beginning of the
well, what's of Ryan Kochevar? What is your role?
I play the Duke of Dutrelage, the resident evil henchman to the governor, of course. Okay.
And he signs his letters, evil henchman to the governor.
Well, he signs it hugs and kisses.
Right.
Yeah, evil henchman. Yeah, well, he's also the best swordsman in Corsica, as far as everyone's concerned, and so he's pitted against Valerio at the end of the show, and during the first part of that sword fight, we were choreographing some of the fight on top of a 4-foot platform, and I made the mistake of saying, I think I can jump that. And jumping off of it.
Jumping off.
Yeah, and yeah, Robert Knott looked up and he said, what do you mean? And I said, I think I can do a handspring off of this. And so it took me about 20 minutes to, you know, finally get up the courage, and then I did it, and it looked awesome. And then the next day, we all had to sign waiver forms.
Damage release forms.
Yeah.
It's true.
They've put together an incredible sword fight to finish the play, and people sitting in the front row get delightfully nervous about it.
That's a good way of phrasing that, yeah.
It's what, a little scary, a little dangerous? I guess that's, if you choreograph a good sword fight, it's going to be a little scary, a little dangerous.
Yeah, I think it's something that's a little surprising to a lot of people who see theater in Santa Fe as, you know, as opposed to the very safe, very slow, you know, sword fighting. We sort of threw caution to the wind.
You ramped it up.
We are prone to do.
And yeah. They are both of adult age, and they did put it together. But I will take, unfortunately, the blame if something goes amiss. They're pretty dynamic fight scenes. And fortunately, a lot of slapstick in comedy.
slapstick, Robert Knott.
So you're not kidding.
Antics. I have to say, I was reading the play, and I'm going through it, and just waiting for the word antics, and it didn't have to. I don't think I had to go past page 3.
Until you saw that. Yeah.
So the two brothers, one of them is a pirate, and the other one is an actor. And the pirate is brave, and the actor is cowardly.
Is not so brave.
That's you're trafficking in stereotypes.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I think when we sat down to write this, we kind of wanted to take some general themes, at least in terms of the characters, and you know, these really strong archetypes that we could sort of pit against each other, not only between the two brothers, but as well as, you know, like Ryan said, the typical evil henchman, which he plays very well. He really captures the smarminess of the Duke.
Right.
All the female characters as well. You know, we have the very sweet, very lovable girl on the clown side of things, and then the sort of tougher, kind of lustier pirate girl on the other side of
things. So. Now, the actor was raised doing basically commedia dell'arte. What is commedia dell'arte?
That's an Italian form, European form of comedy that started 500, 400 years ago, and most of the current comedy we have, most of the film comedy, most of the stage comedy of 100 years ago, vaudeville, all derived from that. The basic archetypes, the elderly doctor who was a quack, and the braggart hero who really wasn't very brave, and the lover, and the Arlecchino character who was basically the clown continually getting duped. And we did build two or three routines out of studying commedia, basic Lazzi, L-A-Z-Z-I gags that were sort of stamped what a performer did. Every comedian has his own style. And really, the Marx Brothers and the Three Stooges, they all go back to comedia, and we have a lot of those sort of routines in the piece. And we did work in some nice comedia bits. And, of course, he's accustomed to using his wit and his comedy to get out of schemes, and the other brother just knows how to use a sword, which often gets him in trouble. So it's a fun mix, we think, so far. We had a great weekend, and we do have a Pay What You Wish some Sunday matinee. I got to plug that. 2:00.
So it's Friday and Saturday at 7:30, and then Sunday at 2:00. Pay What You Wish at Warehouse 21.
Yeah, Sunday.
So in this kind of a play, timing is everything. I would think that's something you have to work very hard on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Ryan would agree that, you know, especially with the comedy, you know, it's very. The way that we wrote it is it's not completely dependent on the physical comedy. I mean, we think there's some pretty clever dialogue as well, and so if that is not played properly, it doesn't really read to the audience. But also, just with the sword fighting, you know,
absolutely,
there's a lot of timing involved in that to make sure that everything goes smoothly. So
it's got to be real, and it's one of the wonders of this cast. Matt knows from working with me before. Ryan was in last year's show. That they have to play the comedy for real, and I have to say I would say all you guys have a knack for timing, a knack for playing it real. Certainly,
what do you mean playing it
Raina,
real?
Raina Urban, for example, plays Aurelia, the sweet girl. She's such a great serious actress. She's playing every moment not as if it's a terrible tragedy, but as if the stakes are incredibly high to her as she tries to pursue love.
Well,
and every actor pretty much follows that through, which is where the comedy really stems from.
There's actually a line that we wrote in the show itself that I think is pretty characteristic of that is the pirate girl asks the clown, thinking that he's the pirate, but she asks him, you know, why are you taking this comedia business so seriously? And his response is, well, that's the only way you can take comedia. And I think that's very, very true. Is, you know, unless you absolutely 100% commit to what's happening around you on stage, it looks fake otherwise. And so you really have to take the funny stuff seriously.
So you have kind of come up, you've been doing this, doing work at Warehouse 21 for some time.
For quite a while, actually. I mean, theater-wise, I did my first show with Robert at Warehouse 4 years ago.
Much Ado About Sleuthing.
Yeah, 4 or 5 years ago. And prior to that, I had been, you know, working with Warehouse since I was in my early teens.
So writing, directing, and acting has always been part of it for you, all three?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, more so the writing and directing recently, but acting has always been a huge, huge part of my life.
And you've also, Ryan Kochevar, come up through Warehouse 21.
Yeah, actually, I was part of the first production that went up
last
year.
In the new space.
Yeah, in the new space of Warehouse, yeah.
Right.
And that had its bumps and bruises, but yeah, Warehouse 21 has really fostered everything after I left Santa Fe High.
So what's happening these days at Warehouse 21? Is it a scene for teenagers, also people who are out of high school, maybe even out of college? What's it like over there these days?
Well, I kind of think that our show is a pretty good cross-section of what's happening over there. I mean, we have actors, you know, our age, 25, 24, 23, all the way down to actors 13 years old. And so I think that's something really interesting about the new space at Warehouse is that, you know, as a program that initially started for, you know, an alternative for kids who couldn't go to shows at bars, that kind of thing. It's really sort of fostered a general safe haven for anyone who wants to, you know, just create stuff, which is really important because I don't think there's really enough of that for young people in Santa Fe to begin with. You know, people ages 18 through 30, there's not really a huge section of stuff.
Right.
Things to do.
Yeah.
So I think they are building that cross-cultural, cross-age group in there, and it's been really wonderful to watch the younger actors learn from the older actors. And we really have no reason to cry.
I love the way you say the older actors.
Yeah, I
was. 24.
I know. Half my age, right? Those. We have no reason to gripe about Warehouse 21, but on the rare occasions when we roll our eyes about a lighting grid or something, we keep remembering we have full creative freedom. Full creative control there, and that is something you can't find. And they do, you know, waiver forms aside, they do trust us. They do, you know, they pop their heads and say, "How's it going? What can we do?" And they leave us alone, and that's an incredible gift. I've done this is my 8th show there, and that's something I love. And it's tough when you're a director not to praise your cast, but they've been really great at directing themselves, coming up with stuff, arguing with me, saying this doesn't work. The other night I said to Ryan, I want this line of dialogue on, and he made an argument. I really like to keep it, and here's why. And it's not that I'm not at the easygoing, but I said, okay, good counter-argument. On the other hand, we cut a bit of business that just wasn't working the first weekend, which is a nice thing about co-directing your own show. Matt and me can look at each other. And Matt is, to his credit, because he's in the play, he'll give me 1% control as the co-director, and that's how that works. And I'll say this really has to go, but he's agreed with everything, and it's a wonderful thing to watch. And, you know, we always say with comedy, we have to see if the audience embraces it. And the first 3 shows they did, it's playing. So
I would think, I mean, co-writing is one thing, but co-directing is a little tricky because there are the two of you supposedly giving directions, and if you don't conflict with each other...
No, there's no... We figured it out. He's playing 2 roles in the play. We knew right ahead.
Yeah.
He pulls me aside. He said some things in front of the cast. I would rather see this. A couple of times he stood up and said, this is what I want you to do, and he's been on the mark. And we have an understanding. I would turn to him and say, and the cast knew this the first night. If I said no, I'm outvoting you, but it's never happened. His choices have been great. A couple nights I couldn't be there, he took over. But he's in the play and he understands that therefore he needs to step back, particularly with his own performance.
Yeah, that's one of the difficult things about, I mean, I would never be in a show that I was directing by myself. Never in a million years. I mean, I know that there are a number of Hollywood actors who, you know, that's the cool thing
that's
to do in Hollywood
do.
Is to, you know, direct and perform in your own opus. But I think that's incredibly irresponsible as both an actor and a director because you can't limit yourself. You can't judge yourself in the areas that you need to on either side of that setup. And so, I mean, it's great to be able to put my 2 cents in as a co-director in the scenes that I'm not in, but I would never try and direct myself. It doesn't work, I don't think.
Now, are there any, do either of you or both want to give us any ideas of snippets of dialogue or the kind of thing that you're going to be hearing, or do you have a scene together?
We do, but all of the dialogue is interspersed in sword fights.
In
so
sword
we'd have
fights.
To clank two knives together, you know, to give you the full effect.
They're doing that at the next table.
Oh.
So the play is called Dead Man's Jest. It's at Warehouse 21, and it's Friday and Saturday at 7:30, and then Sunday, pay what you can. This is the last weekend. How'd the first weekend go?
Interesting.
The opening night.
That's right.
Yeah. Opening night last Thursday night was the same night as the 10-block power outage downtown.
Oh, right.
So we were about half an hour into the first act, and the lights went out.
Nice.
And we were thinking to ourselves, we didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
And so we thought it was just, you know, we blew a fuse, we overloaded the circuits at Warehouse 21, especially after the lights came back on and somebody made the idiotic comment, oh, I think it was an eclipse on stage.
That's a great line. It was Matt's line, and it got a laugh.
I'm not supposed to tell them.
The wonderful thing is that several of us grabbed flashlights and put them on the actors, and they finished Act 1, including the sword fight, and the audience just went wild.
Oh, my goodness.
And their dedication, they didn't break. In fact, I tried to stop it and said to the audience, there's a sword fight, we have to stop, and the audience said, no, 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 and the actors went forward with the flashlights on them. The enthusiasm is great.
We were ready to finish the show. We wanted to do Act 2 just by flashlight, but, you know, safety concerns. We had to clear out the building, which made for kind of a bummer for opening night, but at the same time, it was pretty exciting.
Robert Knott and Matt Sanford are co-authors and co-directors of the new play Dead Man's Jest, Warehouse 21. Ryan Kochevar is actor in the play, is one of the actors in the play, and... for more information, people can...
I think it's 989-4423, Warehouse 21.
Yes, that is Warehouse 21, not your vet's office.
I put the wrong number on the original flyers of my vet who just closed, so it was doubly funny. We fixed it. And we're telling people it's PG-13 because there are some verbal double entendres. But we've had a few kids
you
in the
do those on this show.
We've had some kids who seem to be enjoying it, including the little four-year-old the other night, and... his baby brother who threw his bottle at one of the actors, but it had nothing to do with the performance. Had to do with the contents of the bottle, I think. So it is kind of kid-appropriate, a little few naughty things, so we've had no complaints yet. And it's playing nicely, and it's just a goofy night of theater.
I wouldn't say it's a disclaimer, but all the sort of body stuff, that was exactly our intention, was to sort of borrow from...
Commedia.
Not just Commedia, but also, you know, as a little homage to Shakespearean bodiness, we threw some things in that are all in good spirits and nothing crass, I don't think.
Well, we'll see you tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday. And Matt Sanford, Ryan Kochevar, and Robert Knott, thanks for being here.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break for just a moment. David Robleski is online. We'll be right back. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program David Robleski. He's the author of the best-selling novel and Oprah Book Club pick, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tonight at 6 o'clock, and part of the proceeds from the book sales will go to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Welcome, David.
Hi, good morning.
It's great to have you. I'm a dog person, so this is an unusual and fascinating novel because some of the characters are dogs. And there is a deep observation of the emotions and motivations of dogs in this book. When you were writing the dog characters, were you trying to make accurate and realistic characterizations of the dogs, or is there a necessary component of imaginative license or and even perhaps anthropomorphizing in their characters?
That's a great question. I think that you know, animals in general have an experience of the world that is entirely different from ours because the way we interact with the world is so bound up with our capability for language. We think through words, we experience things through words and so on. And, of course, dogs and other animals don't. So if you're going to render their experience into words at all, you're at some level engaging in some kind of anthropomorphization. And I actually struggled with that a fair amount as I was writing. I resisted writing any of the book from a dog's point of view because I thought that's exactly what I don't want to do. I don't want to have a person in a dog suit in this book. I want a dog as a dog. But in the end, I decided that there were certain compromises that I could make, and I could try and separate the tone and sound of those sections and the sensibility of those sections so that they felt as distinctly non-human as possible.
I think it's such a fascinating read in that, in many regards, but in that regard, because there are things that human beings and animals share, and there are really things that they don't share, and I want to talk more about that in a moment. But what were the inspirations, both literary and real life, that led you to include them in such a profound way? I mean, I couldn't think of, not that I'm so well-read, but I couldn't think of precedents besides Jack London.
Well, first of all, you put your finger on one big precedent. I grew up with a lot of dogs, so in terms of my life experience, when I was a kid, probably from the time I was 4 or 5 years old until I was 10 or 12 years old, my folks raised dogs, and my main job around the farm was to work with the pups, socialize the pups, and so on, and so. You know, that's just part of my early life experience, and I think I imprinted on the experience of being with dogs, viewing them as your equals, your playmates, and so on. What happened for me was a few years went by after I got out of college. I didn't have a dog. First time in my life I hadn't lived with a dog. When I got a dog finally, she was such a great dog that I had this experience of thinking, I'm not a good enough person to have this dog. I need to be a better dog owner. I need to learn about dogs and dog training more than I prided myself on knowing. And I began a sort of investigation into more modern training techniques than I knew, and all the science behind animal cognition that has come out since then. And all that material sort of got put into the blender, I became so interested in that. I wanted to see if there was a way to pose some of that that information in a dramatic framework. So that's at least one source for this book.
The character, Edgar Sawtelle, is born without the ability to speak, but he's normal in every other way. And, of course, he develops deep nonverbal relationships with the dog, particularly the dog Almandine. And I read somewhere that this mute character, Edgar, came from an experience you had when you were young of having had minor surgery, which left you unable to speak for a short time. What about that experience that you had gave rise to this character?
Yeah, I wasn't so young. I was probably around 30.
Oh, okay.
Although now that looks young to me. What happened, I had very minor oral surgery. I had a stitch in my mouth in a place that made it hard for me to talk intelligibly. So, and I knew it was temporary. It wasn't really a problem, but I thought, well, rather than continue to explain this for the next week, I'll just not talk and see how that works. And what I learned from that was that I immediately began to observe the world around me better because I wasn't spending any of my attention trying to figure out what I was going to say or how I was going to engage in conversation. So I noticed the physical world more clearly, and I noticed the social interactions around me more clearly because in some way I wasn't a full participant. And I made a note to myself at the time. I hadn't started working on this book yet, but I was interested in writing a novel of some kind. I knew it was going to involve dogs, and I thought, if I could give a character this quality, with lacking the ability to speak, but being in some sense a linguistic prodigy, that would make them a keen observer of their surroundings, and that's a precious resource when you're telling stories. They have a really smart observer who can pick up on details.
Right.
And so that was how I began the experiment of making him mute in the story. And of course, as you write, you make lots of experiments, and they get tested, and some of them don't work, and they don't. No one ever knows that you made that experiment because it's not in the final form. This was one of those things that dovetailed again and again with other interests in the story, and so it sort of reinforced, and it became more and more central to his character that he lacked the power of speech.
We're talking to David Robleski, author of the best-selling novel The Story of Edgar Sawtelle. You start the book with a quotation from Charles Darwin, and I was thinking a lot about that in terms of the continuity among species. Dogs and people and all sorts of other species can love and suffer, and they can sulk and, you know, be scared and depressed, and they can be joyous. But in this book, so you're drawing on Shakespeare and Hamlet in particular, it seems to me that only human beings are capable of tragedy. And I wanted to know if you thought that was true.
Well, that's a very interesting question. It depends, I guess, on how you define tragedy. But, I mean, I think of tragedy as a literary form that is an investigation into how we process our own mortality, how we deal with that. I don't know of any. I'm kind of a junkie for research into animal cognition and so on. I'm just trying to think whether I've read of any research that bears on this question. And I don't know that we know whether animals are aware of their own mortality.
Right. Yeah, it's something that I think about, because there's the making the grand separation between human beings and animals, there's some truth to that, but the more you look at animals and study them, and the more common ground you find. So it's just, I don't know, it's a question that
I do absolutely agree that we divide the world on this false species boundary that says there's human beings and there's everyone else. And of course, that's the last 20 years of research into, animal behavior, animal cognition, has just every couple of months, another paper or result comes out that says, no, this dividing line that we thought was there is not there. Animals have the same machinery for processing emotion that we have. And so the wall keeps coming down a little further. So I think that at some level, the sense of the emotional basis for tragedy is there in many animals, certainly in dogs that have this very complex emotional life. But what that experience is exactly like, it's one of those things I think we'll be wondering about for a long time.
Right. So this book, it has a character that is totally outside of the feeling of the book is totally outside the digital age. It's a book that, sometimes when I'm reading a book or mystery, you think, oh, this could be a film. But I was reading this book and thinking, this could not be a film. And if it did, it would be a completely different thing. It would lose a great deal. It's a long book. It invites being savored and read slowly for just pleasure in the written word. And I wondered, when you were writing it, did you seclude yourself away from kind of 21st century accoutrements and pace of life and so on?
Well, first of all, thank you. That's exactly the experience I want you to have. I think of it as a very old-fashioned kind of story that is meant to be read slowly and is meant to be an immersive experience. So that's true.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's set in 1972 mainly or earlier, and so it is really a pre-digital age story. But I was not secluded in the way that you suggest. Most of the time that I was writing this book, I was working. My day job was as a software developer, and so I was immersed in the digital world and have been for close to 30 years. So it was really an imaginative exercise on my part, drawing from my childhood, which was growing up on a small farm in central Wisconsin.
At some point when you were younger, you studied theater and I guess wanted to be an actor for a bit. And I've often thought that there's an element of acting in fiction writing, and that you have to totally embody a character that is truly not you, the author or the actor. Do you feel that there's a connection of that kind?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, one way that I think about this book very often is that it is it's a play. I mean, it has five act structure. There are five parts of the story, and in fact, even just thinking of it as structured in five acts was one of the events that got me from imagining writing a novel to getting started writing on it. It absolutely is an exercise in embodying another character. What's great about it is that it, for people like me who have no acting ability at all, which I discovered very early on, is that you can revise it and draft it, and it doesn't happen to it doesn't have to happen in real time. It's not a performance in that way, which is an entirely different set of skills that are certainly beyond me, but I admire them very much in other people, of course.
This was, I think, your first novel. It's very long. It's 562 pages. As you said, it's in five parts. What were the challenges for you in managing such a big project?
Part of the challenge is just keeping everything in my head at once. There comes a time, depending on where you are in the making of a novel, when you're writing the first draft, your goal and the challenge is to just figure out what happens and get to the end of that draft and have some cobbled together form of a story so you know what you're dealing with. But after that, while you're doing revision, the problem increasingly becomes holding the entire thing in your mind at once so that when you're revising one section, you understand that it's going to have an effect somewhere else, because the better put together a novel is, the more tightly things interact. And so you're constantly going through the process of sort of tightening down all the nuts and bolts until any change here has ramifications all over the place. And right. that's where if there's any point where you really need to seclude yourself, for me, that's where it was, because, the phone ringing or the answering email can just erase all that stuff from your head. And there's not, for me at least, there wasn't a lot of extra space once I got the whole novel in my mind at once.
When you finish something like this and it goes to the publisher, it's printed, it's a successful novel, that's a real change in your life. Have you put a new novel in to fill the void, so to speak?
Well, a lot of the last year for me has been spent doing book touring and talking to groups at bookstores like I'll be doing tonight and so on. I am starting on a new novel, it's very hard for me to do first draft work when I'm traveling.
Right.
For some reason, first draft for me is something that happens in my very boring office at home, all white walls, nothing interesting to look at. Revision, second draft and beyond, I actually prefer to do outside of my office. So when I'm home, I'm working on that book. When I'm traveling, I'm generally doing research, and so it's taken a little longer to get started than I'd like, but it's the best problem in the world to have.
David Robleski is author of the novel The Story of Edgar Sawtelle, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock. And once again, part of the proceeds from the book sales will go to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
And we'll see you tonight. We're going to have a little tiny break right now, and Robert Knott is standing by. We'll be right back. And I'm happy now to welcome back Robert Knott. He is not only a playwright, actor, co-director, but he is our man about town, and he's the associate editor of the Pasatiempo Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe, New Mexican. And he's with us here, and he's an education reporter for the New Mexican, and he's with us here speaking of the arts.
Thanks. I'm on the tail end of my two-week vacation, and that was a really smart interview with him. He did a terrific job.
He's a wonderful, wonderful author, David Robleski, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle, which is tonight at 6 o'clock at the Collected Works Bookstore. Yeah, there's a lot of second-rate fiction out there, but this is superb fiction.
I could tell from the way it's been getting great press. It's one of those Oprah picks, which always helps. And tying in with that, oddly enough, this weekend is the Barkin Ball.
I'm going.
I bet you are. 5:30 Saturday at the Santa Fe Convention Center. They generally sell out. You can get some tickets by calling 983-4309.
They may be sold out, but you should definitely
try it. I was there last year. And also, Friday to Sunday this weekend is a Cats collaboration for kitty people.
Aww.
Tonight, for example, at 6 o'clock at Pronzo, David Geist is going to perform music from Cats.
Nice.
Midnight, not a sound in the city. The restaurant's also going to have a raffle of a copy of Judy Chicago's Kitty City, a feline book of ours. And then from 1 to noon to four on Saturday at the Santa Fe Children's Museum. They're going to have a fall harvest festival and Felines and Friends, which helps cats get adopted. They're going to have a cat adoption group there. And then finally, from 1:30 to 3:30 on Sunday, a collected works. Local celebs and politicos, including, I understand, Mayor David Koss, are going to read from children's books, there's going to be refreshments, face painting, everything to do with kitties, benefits, felines, and friends.
Nice!
So a good kitty and puppy dog weekend.
Yes, indeed. That's awesome.
Oh. The cover story of Pasatiempo today is the Laramie Project 10 years later.
Yes, we did an interview on that earlier, that aired earlier this week. And that should be, I'm hoping to go to that too. That's a, should be a wonderful project.
6 p.m. Monday at the Lenzic, 988-1234.
It's a work in progress.
Correct.
Work in process, as they call it. And so.
Taking a look 10 years later at the events surrounding the death of Matthew Shepard and the original piece, The Laramie Project, which has, you know, been performed all over, turned into an HBO movie.
Yeah.
But the script has been sort of kept from the press because they want to keep it secret, so I'm not really
sure. Well, the script has been kept from the press partly because they're still working on it, and they will continue to work on it after the performance, and audience feedback will play a role. They're doing it all over the country on the 11th anniversary of the death of Matthew Shepard, who was killed because he was a young gay man in Laramie, Wyoming, and brought infamy to the city. And the first play, which I saw at the Greer Garson Theater a few years ago,
correct,
was a very, very sensitive and interesting play, because what they did was they took, they recorded the words of a lot of people in the town of Laramie, the police officer and certain religious people and ordinary people and friends of Matt and the bartender and so on. And then they used their exact words as the dialogue of the play, or as the sort of, they're more like a series of monologues in the play.
Right, and it's got a great cast of local actors, including Bob Motton, Scott Harrison, Dan Garrity, KSFR's wonderful voice. 6 o'clock Monday. I don't really know too much more about it.
Yes, 6 o'clock, ladies and gentlemen.
It's
don't show up at 8.
Yeah. You were kind enough to let me plug a show I'm doing at Warehouse, and oddly enough, it ties in with a story that Paul Weideman wrote in today's PASA, which ties in with a lecture by Russell K. Skoronek, Skoronek, 6:30 Thursday.
Who I'm having on the air next week as well.
At the New Mexico History Museum, and it's all about pirates. Arr! It's supposed to be R, not arg, but we always add the GH. What did people think about pirates? What did pirates really do? What sort of antics were they involved with? Well, you should see the lecture. X marks the spot, or does it? You're going to have fun with this. Fact and fiction in the study of piracy. Thursday, 6:30, New Mexico History Museum. It's not too much to get in. School for Advanced Research is hosting it. Call them at 954-7023. And Paul did a really nice story today. Did you grow up liking pirates?
What did the pirate study in college?
What did the pirate study in college? I don't know.
Archaeology.
And I do these jokes and I get lambasted. She doesn't know, so she's got a fan club for archaeology.
What kind of socks does the pirate wear? Argyle.
This is amazing. I got a play over there at Warehouse about the pirates, and she's doing all the shtick here, and she gives me the grief about antics.
you can make up a lot of jokes like that, even without going to the AR part of the dictionary. There is...
Which continent do the pirates like best?
I don't know.
The Arctic.
That's not a continent.
It's not?
No, it's a bunch of ice, which is quickly becoming a bunch of water.
Oh, so my joke's no good. That's
great. You could say Antarctica.
Antarctica? I haven't even met Uncle Arctica. What are you talking about an ant for?
Okay.
That was my joke. That's what happens when you come out on your vacation, ladies and gentlemen. 2 weeks off, I got a beard, I've been sleeping in, taking naps, and I got to come out and be fresh.
I got a note from a high school student that said today that there is a rally that starts at 12:30 at the downtown train station. There are all sorts of students and teachers are doing a rally to protest the proposed cuts to the public school budgets here in New Mexico. I know the state of New Mexico is short of funds, and all sorts of people are... Somebody's going to be cut, and so... Friday, there is a meeting. They're going to walk to the Capitol building with signs and chanting, and a lot of people from the school will be there. From various schools, and students and teachers and so on will be there.
I know. Here I am on my vacation, and the story's breaking, so.
Yep.
Good movie, Zombieland.
Really?
Fun. Woody Harrelson is just a fun B-movie. It's not depressing or gray. It's got great comedy humor, a couple of thrills. 80 minutes long. I went to Regal Stadium 14 yesterday after napping in and getting a late breakfast and having an early beer and saw it. It was just a fun, terrific movie. Goofy. If you want more pressing things, you can consider the New Mexico Museum of Art's exhibit, Man-Made, Notions of Landscape from the Lannan Collection. Opening reception tonight, 5:30, free, at the New Mexico Museum of Art, which, in case you don't know, is at 107 West Palace Avenue. The show runs into January 2010, and you can take a look at Paul Wideman's excellent story in today's Pasatiempo, suggesting that some landscapes can be caught in an explosive manner on photo when you set dynamite off. Meanwhile, Scout's Honor is based on the childhood work of a pair of Native artists, Michael Belmore and Frank Shibageget, pardon me, S-H-E-B-A-G-E-G-E-T. I'm terrible with names. Reception 5 to 7 tonight. Museum of Contemporary Native Arts at 108 Cathedral Place downtown. Buy museum admission. There's going to be a lecture this morning at 10:30 out at the Institute of American Indian Arts at 83 Avenue Poe Road. No charge. Here's a phone number, 983-8900. See Doug Fairfield's story in today's Pasatiempo.
So there is an oil painting demonstration that Sunday, October 11th. It's at the Sunday Community Fair at the, I guess at the Farmer's Market. It says Farmer's Market on here. And it's from 11 to 3 in the afternoon. It's a demonstration of oil painting that travels through several canvases. Each painting focuses on the artist's core interest and elimination of the non-essentials. For more information, 670-6544.
Now, what do you know about the March 4th marching band?
Nothing.
Well, it's not March 4th.
No, but March 4th is both a date and a sentence.
I'm not. I've had a couple of weeks off. I'm just not there this morning.
Sorry. Never mind.
You're zinging me left and right. I had to think about that for 22 seconds. There it is. March 4th, marching band plays Santa Fe Brewing Company at 37 Fireplace at 6:30 Tuesday. They have outfits, and they do trombones, and they have stilt walkers, and... they do salsa, which I know you like.
Yay.
You got to pay to get in. Call the Lenzik. And Vertigo Venus, an Albuquerque group, high-energy group. They're going to bring what Rob DeWall calls post-punk, glam rock, death metal, electronica.
Good heavens.
I know.
That's amazing.
To Santa Fe tonight at Meow Wolf, 1800 2nd Street. Meow. 7 o'clock. There is a slight cover charge.
All right, then.
And what time is it?
8:53. We were cut short because I put an extra interview in today. Sorry about that.
No, don't be sorry.
But the American Guild of Organists, Albuquerque chapter subdean Jane Smith will give a recital on Sunday, October 11th at 4 o'clock at the Shrine of St. Bernadette Catholic Church at 11401 Indian School Road in Northeast in Albuquerque. Free admission. It's part of the 50th anniversary celebration, and Jane will play Bach, Mendelssohn, Franck, and Vierne.
Nice. Theater Grotesco's Richest Dead Men Alive continues down at the Armory for the Arts, 8
Yay.
O'clock tonight, and Saturday, I think a 6 o'clock Sunday show.
That's a fun show. Talk about Commedia dell'arte.
Correct. They also do a lot of their work based on the Commedia dell'arte customs. And there's a contra dance Saturday night, 7:30, Oddfellows Hall. It hasn't been a contra dance in a long time. Beginner classes at 7, live music and calls by Chris Jensen at 7:30. You got to pay to get in. Now, what do you know about the Dykes of Hazzard?
I don't know anything.
I don't know much either, but they're going to be performing at 7 o'clock at Sunday at Back Road Pizza on 2nd Street.
Excellent.
The comedy show. And then the Edwards Twins are up at the Buffalo Thunder Resort and Casino. They perform impersonations of people. Remember when
of
we were...
You? Or no, of famous people?
Of famous people. Of me. It's 2 o'clock on Sunday. It's matinee up there at Buffalo Thunder. Remember that show in the 70s where, like, Rich Little and people would do impersonations of famous people?
Sort of.
Well, of course, you were just a baby at the time.
Yeah, right.
I know your things. Hey. Michael Martin Murphy, 7:30 Wednesday, Santa Fe Brewing Company. Yeah, go ahead.
Monday, October 12th at 1:30, author Janet Smith Warfield has written a book called Shift, Change Your Words, Change Your World. She is a poet, attorney, mediator, mother, and grandmother, and she is exploring the power of words to shape experience in the world. And that is, where is it at?
I don't know.
Oh, Collected Works Bookstore.
Nice. Speaking of books, the 11th annual celebration of the book is Thursday night. Thursday afternoon, 10 to 4. Santa Fe Public Library, the Southside Branch, Jaguar. It's free, 10 to 4, Thursday. And I want to mention the New Mexico Poetry Review at Collected Works, 6 o'clock Thursday. Also, The Lion and the Winner opens next Thursday at the Santa Fe Playhouse with a Pay What You Wish. That's James Goldman's drama, a great movie from the late 60s. Suzanne Lederer directs. I think we're going to have a previous story in next week's Paso Tiempo. And I'll plug once again, and I thank you for letting me plug my piece I wrote with Matt Sanford, Dead Man's Jest,
Dead
at
Man's
Warehouse 21.
Jest.
Pay What You Wish on Sunday. The Paso Tiempo calendar inexplicably says it's Pay What You Wish all weekend. It's not, but it ain't too expensive, believe me. 989-4423.
And Sharon Creighton will be doing a cooking demonstration at the Farmer's Market on Tuesday, the 13th of October. She has a cookbook called One Taste, Vegetarian Home Cooking from Around the World. And the book is kind of a diary of travels into the kitchens and the houses, the homes of people around the world. And it has a Buddhist spirit. And so all of that is on October 13th. That's Tuesday. It doesn't say what time, but
I feel like we preach to the choir, but get all that info in the press releases. Also, I opened one this morning. It was an attachment I couldn't open. You and I often talk about put those press releases
just
in the body of the email.
Don't send us attachments.
Yeah, put it in the body of the
email. Put it in the body of the
email. You never know.
It's a lot easier to read. Because it's just more work for the people who get, 200 emails a day.
It is.
To be continually opening attachments and not be able to sometimes open them, or they open slowly. Sometimes people send you things that are beautiful images, but they're so big that it takes forever to open them, at least on my not brand new computer.
Cut and paste it into the body of the email. So that's it. A lot of stuff happening. Pick up the Paso Tiempo. Take a look. There's a ton of stuff. The Laramie Project, the Bark and Ball, openings at the museums, discussion about pirates. Arg! The Arctic. Turns out the Arctic's not a continent. It figures.
The Arctic is not a continent. How can you say it's...
Well, it's a sea, right? So I can have a joke about the Arctic Sea.
Yes, you can.
Good. Well, that's why they only go to six seas. They skip the Arctic.
And don't forget our wonderful local movie theaters, including the Cinematheque at the CCA.
And the Screen.
Including the Screen. Oh, my.
That's Bright Star running.
Yeah, that's the Keats movie.
That's right.
I've heard some good things about it. I haven't seen it yet.
Jonathan Richards gave it a pretty good review in today's Paso. It opens today. I haven't seen it either.
Is American Casino gone?
It's at DeVargas. It got a not too good review from our reviewer.
Oh, I think it's fabulous.
Well, you do, eh?
American Casino?
Yeah.
It's a documentary about the financial crisis. I thought it was really good. It helped me understand it. It's not easy stuff to understand, and to make a documentary about it that doesn't put you to sleep and that actually...
Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. I was thinking about the Michael Moore movie. You're talking about
American Casino. Capitalism, a Love Story.
Yeah. Sorry, American Casino. I don't know that that's still at the Screen, actually.
Yeah, The DVD is coming out soon. People can probably find a way to rent it. But anyway, you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Robert Knott is with us every Friday. Speaking of the arts.
I had a week off last week, and I took this week off.
Wonderful.
I've been sleeping.
Sleeping is good.
How's my beard look?
It looks scruffy.
Oh, I like the way you said that.
We're streaming live on the web at KSFR. My email address, should you want to write, is radiocafe@ksfr.org. The podcasting site where this show and every show are posted and where you can listen to them anytime, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, is santafe.radiocafe.org. And do you do Facebook?
No, should I?
I don't know. I think that's a personal choice. Who knows if they're collecting all the information. Somebody is collecting all that information. But anyway, I'm at facebook.com/radiocafe. I want to thank Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. And stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Jazz a la Carta. And thanks to you, Robert, and to everybody who helped during our KSFR pledge drive, including all the listeners who donated. And we will see you next week. Have a wonderful week. And be happy.
I'm gonna.
Wear your seatbelt. Have a great play.
Well, thank you, and I'm going to look up the Arctic before I come on next week, and I'll do some facts.
Yeah, we'll do some more Argyle.
Are penguins from the Arctic?
Hasta la vista.
Yeah, but I...
Antarctic. Ciao.